what's this, the 30th. Yeah, I mean...
let me get my notes back out.
Not to take you off track from what you want to talk about.
No, no, you're not. You're not, because... hang on.
I call pessimism essentially a religious disease.
Oh, yeah.
Remember what we're doing is... I have enumerated five the will to believe is a book, but it's a book of essays, and the first of the essays is also the will to believe. So I mean that's I guess that was his most famous essay, and so he named the book after the as I pointed out, the whole book is called The Will to Believe and Other Essays in Popular Philosophy or something like that. I have to go look again, but I don't remember exactly. But what I've been pointing out and what you just alluded to is as you go through the book, at least by my count, there are five arguments that he gives for religious belief. And we've reviewed two of them so far. In fact, we sort of got into the third one a little bit, but not too much. And let me just run through it once again. I mean, it's 10 essays altogether, and seven of the ten have to do with belief. Three of the ten have to do with determinism and free will. We'll get to that at the very end. But the way it breaks down, at least by the way I look at it, and this is a good, nice way to, I think, grasp what's going on. Argument number one, which is, remember, was, as I said, is a version of Pascal's wager argument. That's the main thrust of the will to, the essay titled The Will to Believe. And that's what this part of the board is all about, right? That distinction between living and dead and forced and avoidable and momentous and trivial, and then seeking truth and avoiding error. Those various distinctions and the fact that religious belief, of course, is something that is, something really important, very much like a moral decision. And you're better off laying your bets. You're better off seeking truth than avoiding error. your chances are better. It's so, like I say, it's a version of Pascal's wager argument. The next two is life worth living and the sentiment of rationality. That's the one that Tom was just talking about. And that last quote that you just read is another version of the remember the chasm that you're jumping over? Remember that analogy?
It's in there, too.
Yeah. And it's in both of them, actually. And the idea is if you really think you're going to make it, you're increasing your chances of making it. And we talked about exactly how that's supposed to apply to religious belief last time. And the third argument is in the next essay called Reflex Action and Theism. And that's where we're headed today. And we'll see how far we get. We'll probably get through that. But I don't know how far we get. But anyway, just to kind of give you the big picture again. Then the next argument, which is a version of the moral argument, is in The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life. And then the last argument is, it's tied in with his metaphysics, which, interestingly, William James is basically a Neoplatonist.
Really?
Anyway, the last one is in Some Hegelisms and What Psychical Research Has Accomplished. So, altogether, we're talking about five arguments for religious belief. And we've talked about two of the five, and we sort of started talking about number three.
Can I mention one other thing from Will to Believe?
Yeah.
I did, Is Life Worth Living?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's actually a theme in a bunch of them, and I suggest people read these. They're not very long.
No, they're
hard
very readable.
Read,
yeah.
At least I did, and for me who can't read philosophy, I thought they were pretty good. Anyway, he talks a lot about suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Not just his life, it's not just the good life, but life at all, mm-hmm. which is really, you could argue, is the theme of it. Anyway, he says that, one of the arguments against suicide is God says you're not allowed to, as he said, the thou shalt not argument. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was interesting. He says, If that's the best you can bring to the argument, your religion isn't worth anything. You need more than that. Uh-huh. You've got to have more to offer, like eternal life.
I see what you mean.
And optimism. You can't just say, God says it's only for God to decide uh-huh. whether you live or die.
Uh-huh.
He says, that's too lame.
Uh-huh.
That's nothing. There's no meat to that. That's nothing to inspire you toward.
Yeah. Yeah, life still may not be worth living under those circumstances. You're just not taking it because,
right.
you know.
So,
yeah.
And he also gives the not-so-gracious argument, I could say, is that if you're thinking of suicide, you should maybe remind yourself that your problems compared to those of the big world are not that much. Compared to, like, the plague.
Yeah.
So it was almost like a get-over-it, Don.
Yeah, right.
Which I thought was, if I interpret, was not the most charitable.
Yeah.
Right, like, you know,
yeah.
your problems aren't
yeah.
that bad.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
can they be that bad? That's not very nice.
Yeah.
Anyway,
You're reading this online, right?
Oh yeah, all this stuff is online.
But I mean, are they? Is it all together? And I mean, is the entire book there as such?
I suppose, but I just look.
Oh, you mean
I
just
read
Google
the essay as a PDF.
I know, but how'd you know about the "Is Life Worth Living" title? Because I said so. Because I named it. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I had written it down, and so I just searched
it.
William James' quote, "Is Life Worth Living?"
I see.
And there it was.
Well, you might want to then look at reflex action and theism, because that's what we're going to talk about today. And by the way, the first three of the five arguments, the first three arguments are the ones that are most closely tied in with his pragmatic framework. Remember, the whole deal with William James is he takes this boundary and, you know, really expands it. And as I said last week, I think it's not so much that he's saying you should believe without evidence. It's really he's saying what counts as evidence is broader than what some thinkers would hold, really. In other words, it's not just, can I perceive it? Is it deducible mathematically? But there are other facets of human experience that also count as evidence. And that's why he draws the circle much bigger. So anyway, let's look at reflex action and theism. And I have to find, let's see now, this is my yellow one. I have all these color-coded things. And I want to start here. Okie dokie. now he makes a distinction. He makes a distinction at first, and here's what he says. The structural unit of the nervous system is in fact a triad. This is very important. It's in fact a triad, he says. Neither of whose elements has any independent existence. He should say none, shouldn't he?
Not neither.
Oh, well.
Right. I was thinking the same
three.
Thing, but thought I should bite my tongue.
Well, anyway. The sensory impression exists only for the sake of waking the central process of reflection, and the central process of reflection exists only for the sake of calling forth the final act. So you see, you have a sort of a three-stage kind of thing. The sensation, the reflection, and the action that's going to play into this triad he's advertising. All action is thus reaction upon the outer world, because the outer world is the first actor in this original sensation. And the middle stage of consideration or contemplation or thinking is only a place of transit, the bottom of a loop, both whose ends have their point of application in the outer world. So you start with the outer world, it comes in briefly, you think about it, and, you know, then it goes back out again when you act. If it should ever have no roots in the outer world, if it should ever happen that it led to no active measures, this is his pragmatism, of course, coming out full force, it would fail of its essential function and would have to be considered either pathological or abortive. The current of life, which runs in at our eyes or is meant to run in at our hands and feet, is meant to run out. Sorry, let me read that sentence again. The current of life, which runs in at our eyes or ears, forget about that one, is meant to run out at our hands, feet, and lips. The only use of the thoughts it occasions while inside is to determine its direction to whichever of these organs shall, on the whole, under the circumstances actually present, act in the way most propitious to our welfare. Okay, so that's his model, this three-stage kind of thing. We get some sort of impression from outside, there's something going around inside, and then we act. So it's this kind of U-shaped loop is the way he's envisioning it. The willing department of our nature, in short, dominates both the conceiving department and the feeling department, or in plainer English, perception and thinking are only there for behavior's sake. Okay, so let me put that on the board. Let me find a spot. I'll put it over here in the indelible portion of the board. So we have perception. That's really. There's no trash can in this room, is there? Here, Patty. Try this one. Perception.
We can take it afterwards.
What was it? Thinking, was that the word he used? Yeah, thinking. Yes. And then willing. Obviously, this whole thing is very closely tied in with the big title, the will to believe. This is title. This is part of that too, even though the other essay had the actual name. So anyway, the picture he has, if this is inside, and this is outside, here's his picture, right? Kind of coming this way. You think about it a little bit, and then boom, going here.
Oh, yeah.
So this is perception, this is thinking, and this is willing. Over here. So that's the picture. Okay. Now, obviously, as a pragmatist, you can tell just from what I read that it's the willing part that really gets the star role here, and that comes out in spades in the next thing I'm going to read. The study of what the mind's criteria of rationality are, the definition of its exactions in this respect, form an intensely interesting subject into which I cannot enter now with any detail. But so much I think you will grant me without argument that all three departments of the mind alike have a vote in the matter, and that no conception will pass muster which violates any of their essential modes of activity or which leaves them without a chance to work. By what title is it that every would-be universal formula, every system of philosophy which rears its head, receives the inevitable critical volley from one half of mankind and falls to the rear to become at the very best the creed of some partial sect? Either it has dropped out of its net in some of our impressions of sense, what we call the facts of nature, or it has left the theoretic and defining department with a lot of inconsistencies and unmediated transitions on its hands. Or else, see, once again, he shouldn't have said either. But anyway, or else, finally, it has left some one or more of our fundamental active and emotional powers with no object outside of themselves to react on or to live for. There's your is life worth living theme again. So in other words, if something has failed, if a worldview has failed for some reason, or just confines itself to only a small sect and is rejected by lots and lots and lots of people, it's failed. Maybe what he should have said is one or more of these respects. Because, of course, it could fail in two. It could fail in all three, even, you know, right? But the idea is there are three tribunes here. Remember the old Roman tribune. Veto, I forbid. That's where we get the word veto, right? And they were able to, when the Senate came up with something, they could say, no, I'm vetoing it. And then that was that. They were the popular, you know, people. Anyway, they were from the plebeians. But anyway, so each of But anyway, any one of those three can veto, as it were, the any idea that's espoused by any of the other two, or as I said, all three. You know, if it so, there are really three decision makers here: perception, thinking, and willing. And that's the main difference between James and the logical positivists who would come along in the 1930s, because the positivists would accept perception and thinking, certainly. For them, the meaning of a statement is its method of verification, and there are two methods of verification. Either you reduce what is being said to observation statements, and you go out and look, and that's the empirical side, the perceptional side. Or it's a matter of logical deduction, as in mathematics. And so they would be happy to go along with James on those two grounds. But the thing that James adds to the what would become the logical positivist credo is that there's another factor there that has a say, and that is our willing nature. And also these three faculties also sort of describe three personality types, don't they? Because, I mean, obviously, all of us have all three. But in some people, one or the other is more dominant. And so that's interesting as well, an interesting consequence of his theory as well. So anyway, the whole idea here is not, as I keep on saying, not that we believe as on lack of evidence, but rather that the idea of what counts as evidence needs to be expanded. And that's a different claim. It needs to include willing as well as thinking and perceiving. Now, exactly what that boils down to, you know, I don't know. I mean, a critic could certainly say, well, it doesn't make any difference what you will. I mean, I might want to be immortal or something, but that's not going to change things. I can want to do something as much as I possibly can, and yet I make just shatter against obdurate, you know, reality. That's the way it is. So, but on the other hand, you could construe willing as sort of gut feeling. And I think we have a better appreciation now of the fact that there's a lot going on in your head that you're not really conscious of, you know? I mean, there's this blind sight. I remember reading years and years ago there's a book on the philosophy of mind, and they were talking about some experiments. And one of the experiments, the one I remember, is this blind sight phenomenon where you present an image to that will just go into the right brain, and so it's not consciously perceived. And then you ask the person to maybe make a or see what you're ask the person, what are you thinking of right now, or something like that. And like 75% of the time, they would guess right, even though they really couldn't, or well, they obviously did see it, but it was not seen by the conscious part of the brain. You know, what goes in the left eye goes to the right brain, and the right brain is the unconscious part. So something's going on there. And you and I have all had the same kinds of experiences, you know, where you can't think of a name or something, and you leave it aside, and then 2 hours later, it just pops in. Well, where'd that come from? Well, something was going on in the meantime, right? And so, yeah, some sort of intuitive feeling about things that maybe what, or partly is covered by James's idea of willing. You know, maybe that's part of what's going on here as well. And then maybe that's a possible answer to the criticism. Well, wait a minute, I don't care what you want. The facts are the facts, you know. You're not going to affect them by what you want.
but maybe willing would also include something like what we call gut feel. Anyway, maybe. Well, anyway, there's more to this. Let me read a little bit more from this same essay. And we'll pick up the idea. Well, he says, just as within the limits of theism, some kinds are surviving others by reason of their greater practical rationality, so theism itself, by reason of its practical rationality, is certain to survive all lower creeds. Right? Because, as I said a minute ago, this is partly a matter of personality types. And some people are more on the volitional side of things and are more willing to use, no pun intended, the will as a criterion in what they're deciding to believe. Not everybody is a scientific type of person, you know. Materialism and agnosticism, even were they true, could never gain universal and popular acceptance, for they both alike give a solution of things which is irrational to the practical mind of our nature, and in which we can never volitionally feel at home. Each comes out of the second or theoretic stage of mental functioning with its definition of the essential nature of things, its formula of formulas prepared. The whole array of active forces of our nature stands waiting, impatient for the word which shall tell them how to discharge themselves most deeply and worthily upon life. Well, they cry, what shall we do? Ignoramus ignorabimus, says agnosticism. In other words, we are ignorant and we shall be ignorant. React upon atoms and their concussions, says materialism. What a collapse. The middle train misses fire. The middle fails to ignite the end. The cycle breaks down halfway to its own conclusion. And the active power is left alone with no proper object on which to vent their energy, must either atrophy, sicken, and die, or else by their pent-up convulsions and excitement keep the whole machinery in a fever until some less incommensurable solution, some more practically rational formula, shall provide a normal issue for the currents of the soul. So, yeah. So, volitional nature, has got to have a say. It's not enough just to pass muster with perception and thinking. Now, theism always stands ready with the most practically rational solution it is possible to conceive. Not an energy of our active nature to which it does not authoritatively appeal, not an emotion of which it does not normally and naturally release the springs. At a single stroke, it changes the dead blank of the world into a living thou, with whom the whole man may have dealings. To you, at any rate, I need waste no words in trying to prove its supreme commensurateness with all the demands that Department Number 3 of the mind has the power to impose on Department Number 2. Our volitional nature must then, until the end of time, exert a constant pressure upon the other departments of the mind to induce them to function to theistic conclusions. No contrary formulas can be more than provisionally held. Infra-theistic theories must be always in unstable equilibrium, for Department Number 3 ever lurks in ambush, ready to assert its rights, and on the slightest show of justification, it makes its fatal spring and converts them into the other form in which the mental peace and order can permanently reign. So the Department Number 3, that is the volitional nature, is always there in ambush, ready to pronounce its possible veto over what passes muster from a perceptional perspective, i.e. the facts that we can experience, and from a intellectual perspective, the thinking part of our minds. So the first three of the five arguments, the wager one, the leap one, the practical pragmatic one, I think I called it in my notes, and the volitional argument, all of them are closely related, obviously, to the pragmatic theory that we spent several months going over. But this one is, I think, most closely related and fleshes it out better than anything else. Because what he's saying is that what counts as evidence simply needs to be more capacious. It needs to include more inputs from our psychological nature than a strict sort of positivistic, a narrow positivistic viewpoint would countenance. And I tried to make that, trying to see it as more plausible by perhaps casting the volition idea as something like gut feeling. As Pascal said, the heart has reasons that the reason cannot know, or something along those lines. Some sort of gut feeling that our unconscious self determines to be likely to be true, and that we stand a better chance of having a full-fledged understanding of reality if we include something like this rather, well, unconscious, I'll say, element of evidence. So.